for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. For many people, the word jellyfish means just one thing, fear of being stung. But for scientists who study them, jellyfish are fascinating creatures, beautiful and strange, and now, according to some experts, more numerous than ever. For this month's Environmental Outlook, understanding jellyfish and their connection to a changing environment. Here with me, Bill Dennison of the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Sciences, Jack Cover from the National Aquarium, and joining us from Omaha, Nebraska, Lisa Ann Gershwin. She's author of a new book titled Stung, on Jellyfish Blooms and the Future of the Ocean. Throughout the hour, I'll look forward to hearing your comments. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. And good morning to all of you.
Morning.
Good morning.
Good to have you with us. Lisa, I'm going to start with you after I tell folks that if you go to our website, drshow.org, you'll see photographs of different types, different species of jellyfish, and they are gorgeous. You'll also see some little-known facts about jellyfish up there on the website. And let's start with the basics, Lisa, because these jellyfish are not fish. What are they?
Well, they're actually invertebrates. So they're in a phylum that contains the corals and the sea anemones and all of those fabulous, weird creatures very, very low on the evolutionary tree. And all of these creatures have stinging cells, and that's why we think of jellyfish as things that sting. But like you so rightly pointed out earlier, that jellyfish are really causing a lot more problems than just stinging.
Indeed.
And this is something that we didn't realize for for all of history, really. And it's only been in the last, few years that we've come to realize that jellyfish are capable of absolutely devastating ecosystems. Not only capable, but they actually are.
It's interesting because I grew up thinking that cockroaches were going to be the last creatures
absolutely
left on Earth. But you seem to imply that these jellyfish are reproducing in such quantities that indeed they may replace the cockroaches. First, I want to turn to you, Jack Cover. You call jellyfish living lava lamps. What do you mean?
Well, for one thing, aquariums have display jellies, and it took a sort of a long way, first of all, to figure out how we could keep jellyfish in an aquarium setting. You have to recreate their environment. But we first weren't sure how visitors would sort of receive looking at jellyfish. And you could see from those images, they really are beautiful animals. So
you called it an animal.
Yeah.
Do you think of it as an animal?
They're definitely animals. And they've been around a long time. They've been around for over 500 million years. They don't have a brain. They don't have any bones. They don't have blood. They're very simple animals. So
what gives them their color and their shape?
Well, though, basically, again, with the different types of jellies, there are different classes, and the Scyphozoans are the kind of the classic Medusa jellyfish, the one that has the umbrella that pulses with the tentacles. So there are many beautiful ones, and then there's a whole different phylum, the Ctenophores, which we loosely classify as jellies too, that aren't not stinging. They can produce colors, and I think we have an image of one of those. They can actually refract light, but what we find is in our displays that we're first wondering how people would receive it, because most people really remember jellyfish as something that stung them when they were on their vacation or that gobby thing on the beach. But when we found we could display them, we found that visitors were fascinated by their movements, by their colors.
Indeed.
And it's really relaxing. And so it really is like you go into our jelly room, our display at the National Aquarium. It's very relaxing.
And Bill, they're not only relaxing, you call them very cool.
I think they're amazing animals. One term that we use is they're just organized water. There's very little actual organic material in the jelly. So if you dry a jelly down and take out all the water, you end up with, in fact, what's left is even, most of that isn't even organic. It's salts. So jelly is a very loosely organic material that's captured water and does amazing things with it. They can move, even some of them can swim quite strongly against currents. So they're amazing what they can do with so little.
And Lisa, what do they actually eat?
Well, most jellyfish will eat just about anything they can get their lips around. But what concerns us the most is that they have a strong propensity to eat eggs and larvae of other species.
I see.
And they also eat the plankton that the larvae would eat. So this double whammy of predation and competition can actually flatten populations of fish and crustaceans and mollusks and all of these things that make up a healthy ecosystem. They not only flatten it, but they can keep these populations from coming back through this double whammy.
And you write that the way jellyfish reproduce is, quote, straight out of science fiction. Talk about that.
Oh, it's true. They can clone in 13 different ways. They have a weird, weird life cycle that's nothing like anything we know, where when the jellyfish have babies, they don't grow up to look like jellyfish. They grow up to look like little tiny sea anemones or little coral polyps. And they have this weird sort of alternation of generations, and this allows them to be the weedy, weedy creatures that they are, because they can hide in their little tiny phases that are stuck to rocks and shells and things, and then when the conditions are right, they bloom in fantastic numbers, and we see unbelievable blooms of jellyfish sometimes that cover thousands of miles. In those sort of numbers, each one of them is looking to eat whatever it can.
Lisa Ann Gershwin, she's the author of a new book. It's titled Stung on Jellyfish Blooms and the Future of the Ocean. Pardon me. Talk about how you are connecting those two elements, Lisa. As you talk about the future of the ocean, how are jellyfish affecting it?
Well, we're seeing many places around the world that are heavily disturbed by human activity through either overfishing or pollution or warming water or a variety of different impacts or sometimes a combination of impacts. And these damaged ecosystems are actually flipping to being dominated by jellyfish instead of fish. And it's a very frightening thing when you think about something so small and insignificant can have such an incredible power to transform the oceans in ways that aren't very good for us. And we're actually seeing this happening in many places around the world already.
Bill Dennison, would you agree?
Well, I think Lisa's got a point that overabundance of jellyfish is a symptom of a system that's out of whack. But some of my scientific colleagues have recently published a series of papers earlier this year that talk about they went and looked for the data that supports that assertion that jellyfish are flipping and taking over the ocean. And when they're finding that, in fact, there's a 20-year cycle of jellyfish blooms and declines, and so the reports are all focused on the increases.
I see. So
you tend to focus on that. And then secondly, that looking at it globally, there are places, and Lisa brings it out really well in the book, of introduced species like into the Black Sea, where jellyfish have taken over. But overall, they've not seen a major trend. Maybe since 1970, a slight increase, but nothing catastrophic.
Now, would this be in all the oceans, Lisa, or are you just talking about one ocean?
No, it's in all the oceans, but it's not every species, and it's not every species everywhere. So the papers that my colleague has just referred to looked at a larger scale where they looked at every species everywhere and found that there was so much noise that a pattern couldn't be discerned. But when you look at certain disturbed areas and you look at certain types of species in these certain disturbed areas, we are finding dramatic increases.
Explain
in some
what
places.
You mean by disturbed.
Well, overfishing seems to be a really common thread, although it's not the only thread, but that is a common thing that's happening in many of these disturbed places that are being taken over by jellyfish. What we call eutrophication, which is kind of a fancy word for too much fertilizer. Mm-hmm. So when coastal areas have too much farm fertilizer running down in the rivers or too much sewage effluent from cities, we see these chemistry changes in the water that the jellyfish can do really well in these areas, but many other species can't because of a change in the oxygen. There's not enough oxygen for most species to be able to survive. And, there's warming waters as well. Jellyfish can do really well, but other species that need to get oxygen from the water, of course, warm water holds less oxygen than cold water, so the jellyfish can do better.
Lisa Gershwin. Her new book is titled Stung on Jellyfish Blooms and the Future of the Ocean. Do join us. Short break. Right back. And for this month's environmental program, we are talking about jellyfish. And with me here in the studio, Bill Dennison. He's Vice President for Science Applications, Professor at the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Sciences. Also, Jack Cover. He's General Curator at the National Aquarium. Joining us from Omaha, Nebraska, Lisa Ann Gershwin. She is the author of a new book. It's titled Stung on Jellyfish Blooms and the Future of the Ocean. She's the Director of the Australian Stinger Advisory Services. Here's an email saying, does anything eat jellyfish? Jack Dover.
Well, there's actually a number of animals that do eat jellyfish. All seven species of sea turtles will opportunistically feed on jellyfish. In fact, the largest sea turtle, one of the largest reptiles in the world, the leatherback sea turtle, is a jellivore. And here Bill was talking about the percentage water. Jellies are 95% water. But this particular sea turtle will actually travel, lay its eggs in the tropics on a beach in Suriname, travel thousands of miles up of Nova Scotia into very cold water because that's where we have some incredibly large jellyfish and big blooms. So it actually just will mine through the jellyfish. There's also a lot of fish that eat jellyfish. And relationships here in the Chesapeake Bay, we see at the end of the summer, we see some fish that their larvae, their young fish, will hide in the jellyfish stingers.
Huh.
They're protected. They actually have a mucus that protects them. And
my
this is
goodness.
The butterfish and harvest fish. And kind of a dirty trick. Eventually, when they grow, they actually then start eating the jellyfish. All's fair in nature when it comes to survival. But there are a lot of things that depend on jellyfish. So they are part of the ecosystem, and we have to have them.
And Bill Dennison, tell me about these man-of-war jellyfish.
The Portuguese man-of-war, which is
huge,
long tentacles. And my personal experience was not, my first encounter was not a pleasant one. I ended up getting a whole swath of stingers across my neck. I could feel my heart begin
wow.
to race because wow. it's got this toxin in it.
Yeah.
But they're very, they're commensal, and they have lots of different organisms living together, including a lot of fish that live down in the tentacles. And so they're beautiful purple and pink and translucent. And these things blow across the ocean. Some of these, you can find these out in the middle of the ocean as well as coastal.
And you can find them. I was once in Bermuda and could see them coming fairly close to the shore. What about those larger types, Lisa? Are they also reproducing in quantities that give you concern?
We're not seeing the man-of-war in any sort of problematical blooms that I'm aware of. I mean, we certainly do get vast armadas of them blowing ashore seasonally, but they don't seem to be responding to these different stressors in the same way that some other species are, which is a good thing because they are very stingy, and of course they can even kill people. But they don't seem to be doing the damage to the ecosystem that we're seeing with others.
And what kind of damage do you really believe could be happening for the long term, as opposed to, as Bill Dennison pointed out earlier, part of a natural 20-year cycle?
Well, jellyfish do bloom as a natural part of their own life cycle, but it's more a matter of when the conditions are right, they're simply exploiting the conditions that we're giving them. You know, the warming water, the lack of predators and competitors, the changes in oxygen, the changes in water chemistry. And as it becomes harder and harder for fish to survive these conditions, the jellyfish are taking up that slack, or in some cases, they're just the last man standing. Like I said earlier, it's not every jellyfish species in every place, but there are some of these locations around the world where some types of jellyfish are responding in ways that are not good for us at all.
And you write about Fukushima. Talk about that and nuclear waste.
Yes. We've certainly dumped an awful lot of nuclear waste through the years. And I don't know of any direct correlation between nuclear waste and jellyfish. But again, as it gets harder for other species to survive, jellyfish are often simply not affected by these same problems, and they're just the last man standing.
And Jack Cover, as you direct the aquarium and have this jellyfish exhibit, what kinds of research are you doing there?
Well, we're looking again, and the biggest thing we're doing is really trying to bring this topic to our visitors. But we're, you know, again, when we're stocking this exhibit, we're out on the bay every year sort of looking at the jellyfish populations, and they do go up and down. And as Lisa said, the jellyfish are opportunistic. If there's food there for them, and we have fortunate challenge with the Chesapeake Bay as well as the Mississippi River where there's a lot of nutrients going in. We have dead zones in the bay, and the Atlantic sea nettle seems to do quite well.
Huh.
But to just tell you the potential, you know, again, for their populations and how you, one day you're on the bay, you see three jellyfish, the next day you see thousands of jellyfish. The Atlantic sea nettle, a female can lay 45,000 eggs every day. So they're, that's why it's just geometric progression. But what we have at the aquarium in our exhibit is called Jellies, Invasions, Oceans Out of Balance. We really present all these things, and we also try to let people know they're connected to the bay, to the ocean. One would never think that the amount of fertilizer you put on your lawn actually has an effect on jellyfish. So if you over-fertilize your lawn, you're a friend of jellyfish. You're basically putting more nutrients in, and all these things are connected. So that's really a mission of the aquarium, is really to try to show that we are a part of this big, big system.
But explain how a person living in the city fertilizing his or her lawn helps to feed the jellyfish.
Well, what happens is we're if you're in the Chesapeake Bay watershed, picture that as a big bowl. Every time it rains, everything on the sides of that bowl wash into the bay, which eventually empties into the ocean. So if you're Americans are sort of obsessed with this lawn thing, you know, way too much. But we basically over-fertilize our lawn, and we put more fertilizer than the lawn can use. So every rain event, that all washes into a local stream, which washes into a river, which washes into the bay. So what we're doing, we're feeding algae blooms. So we are over-fertilizing the bay. Mm-hmm. Suddenly you'll have this bloom of algae that's consuming all this nitrogen that we're putting into the bay. That will eventually eat all the nitrogen, and it will be a massive die-off of the algae, which then sinks to the bottom, and then we have a bacterial bloom. The bacterial bloom sucks all the oxygen out of the water. So we have what we call a dead zone. Fish that are in, crabs that are in that dead zone, they're dead. Jellies, again, can really survive really low oxygen levels. So they're basically doing fine, and the fish that have been eliminated were competitors to the jellyfish.
And
there's more food for them.
Bill Dennison, right now in the Chesapeake, for example, what are we seeing as to the crab population, the jellyfish population?
Well, Diane, the Chesapeake Bay crab story is actually a pretty good story, because we've had some aggressive moves by Virginia and Maryland to reduce the catch of pregnant females. And so now our crab population seems to be stabilized, and we are hoping to start to see an increase. We had a couple good years. It wasn't so good, but we think we have a management under control. The jellies, we had a guy, one of our faculty, for 25 years, walked up and down the dock every day at noon, and
counting
the jellies, and, huh. And saw they went up and then they went down depending on the rain and weather, but no long-term trend. That's for the sea nettles, and one of the things that we're starting to look at for the bay is the impact of all the nutrients that we put in, from lawn fertilizer,
sure,
but agricultural and sewage, and we got some good news recently. So We're actually reducing the amount of fallout from the atmosphere. There's less nitrogen coming down. The Clean Air Act is working, so we're actually reducing the nitrate in the streams in the forested parts of the watershed. We're looking at our sewage upgrades that we've instituted throughout the bay, and they're working. So we're getting some recovery of the submerged grasses, and that provides a positive synergy.
Okay, I want to go back and ask you about that experience of being stung by a man of war and where you were and how it affected you both short and long term.
Oh, yeah, the man of war, and I should have pointed out the reason they are called a Portuguese man of war is because they have a sail, a balloon that they inflate with gas and that sticks above the surface and catches the wind, and so
yes,
it moves, it sails.
Seen it.
Yep, and I was in St. Croix, and I was training to be an aquanaut on one of the underwater habitats, so I was swimming. Part of my training was to swim, and I'd swim offshore pretty far, like a mile, and then turn around at this buoy and swim
and
back.
And had you been told that man of war were present?
No. And you know, you don't always have good warning for it. And I looked up and saw the sail, but the sail was 30 feet away. Those tentacles are really long.
Whoa.
They string out through the water.
Yeah.
So anyway, I was pretty far away from shore, so what I was worried about is my heart rate started racing, and I did have a stinger shirt on, but didn't protect my neck. In Australia, when you go in the waters, you tend to wear a full body suit, and you don't expose much skin.
You don't fool around.
Well, it turns out the little stingers, the nematocysts, which are these spring-loaded little traps that spring a little dart with the toxin into your skin, they're relatively short. So even pantyhose or lycra suit is thick enough to keep the stinger from actually penetrating your skin. So as long as you have something on your skin surface, you're protected. But it's hard often to cover your entire body, particularly your face and neck, if you've got a mask and snorkel on. So that's where I got it, across my neck. And that was probably as far away as I'd want to be and feel that badly.
And you managed to swim back in.
Yeah.
How long did that man of war hold on?
Oh, I think it probably washed off right away, but those nematocysts you could actually count the stings across your neck.
I would not wish to do that. Thank you, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We've got some questions on our line, so let's open the phones. First to Rick in Fayetteville, North Carolina. Good morning to you.
Oh, good morning, Diane.
Hi.
My question for your guest is kind of taking, the analogy of a forest, which is a complex ecosystem like the ocean. And when you clear-cut a forest, the first thing you have grow back are grass and shrubs. So I was wondering if, in the process of, overfishing and everything else that we're doing to destroy the ocean, if we're not creating basically a clear-cut area and jellyfish are just the first thing that starts to come back because they're so resilient.
Lisa.
Look, that's a really good question. And that is the first thing that is kind of coming back. But it doesn't seem to be part of a succession because of this double whammy of predation and competition. We're not seeing the rest of the succession take place. Many of these disturbed ecosystems that have flipped to jellyfish domination have been going this way for decades, and there doesn't seem to be any changeover to what's next. Maybe it's just too short a period of time. Maybe something will take over. But of course, the stimuli that have caused the disturbance in the first place are still happening. We're still fishing, we're still discharging nutrients, we're still warming the waters, et cetera, et cetera.
And why is it, Lisa, that as you argue in your book, more than any other factor, temperature both stimulates and controls jellyfish populations?
Well, temperature is very complex. Warmer water stimulates just about everything to grow faster, breed more, et cetera, et cetera. You know, our own metabolisms speed up when it's warmer. So that's a common thing that we see. In the case of jellyfish, they're not affected by it very much. If it gets too warm, they're affected. But by then, everything else is seriously affected. But because colder water holds more oxygen and warmer water holds less oxygen, things that need to breathe more struggle way before jellyfish are in any distress at all.
I see. All right, let's take a caller in Jacksonville, Florida. Hi there, Robert.
Good morning, Diane.
Good morning.
I've always been interested in turtles, and I've noticed that over the years the decline of turtles goes along with the increase of jellyfish. The turtles seem to have jellyfish as one of their main diets. And I'm wondering what your guests think about that. And also the box jelly, which is, I believe, one of the smallest and one of the most dangerous and has one of the strongest nematocytes that can kill you within a few minutes. And I walked 1 year for looking for jelly, for turtles in the beach area in my area, found one nest that had 180 eggs in it. But the point being that when those eggs were hatched, very few of them survived, the turtles, that is. That's what the nest I was looking for. But I'm wondering what they think about the decrease of turtles and the increase of jellyfish.
All right. And Bill Dennison.
Well, those are a couple of really good points, and I think the decline of sea turtles worldwide is really a big concern, and it usually has much more to do with the fishing pressure. A lot of nets that are not intended to catch turtles catch them in their reptiles, which need to breathe air, so if they don't get to the surface, they suffocate, they drown. So there's there's this movement to put turtle exclusion devices in the nets to allow them to escape, and then secondly, people eat the eggs, and particularly in developing countries.
Bill Dennison, he's professor at the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Sciences. Short break here. More of your calls when we come back.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org, by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, the widening war in Syria. The leader of the Lebanese political and military group Hezbollah has declared his support of the Syrian president against the rebels. And the war is spreading into Lebanon. Fighters from other countries are coming to Syria. We'll talk with Robert Malley, the International Crisis Group's program director for the Middle East and North Africa. Join us.
And for this month's Environmental Outlook, we're talking about jellyfish. And of course, as a young girl living here in the Washington area, going down to North and Chesapeake beaches, I would encounter them a great deal in those areas. But we just had John send us a photograph. He says he Googled images for jellyfish blooms and came up with a picture that makes certain jellyfish look as big as a human. Are they real jellyfish? And I'm holding this photograph up for our two guests here in the studio, Bill Dennison and Jack Cover, to see. Lisa, you'll just have to wait and see it on our website at drshow.org. How much do you figure, Jack Cover, this jellyfish weighs?
That particular species is a Nemura jelly, and they're about the weight of a grizzly bear. They can be 450 to 500 pounds. And
wow.
That's actually not even the largest species. There's a species called the lion's mane jelly that you would find up in Nova Scotia that's even bigger than that. The lion's mane would have a bell about 10 feet across. It's like a big satellite dish with tentacles that trail about 100 feet behind it. So that's like two school bus lengths of tentacles.
So what happens when a whale, for example, or a shark confronts a jellyfish that is that big, Bill Dennison?
Well, I think they avoid them.
They
definitely do. It turns out, the turtles go and find them and eat them.
The big ones?
Not the huge ones. But one of the dangers about one of the reasons why helium balloons are and plastic bags are a problem with in terms of trash and is that they make their way into the sea. You know, the balloons float away and land in the sea, or the plastic bags, the shopping bags, float down the drain and into the sea. And the turtles mistake those for jellies,
and they ingest them.
Some of the turtles they found stranded, or their stomachs are just packed full of plastic.
Trash bags.
Yeah, so that's a real, and it stops up their gut.
Have you, Lisa, ever seen one of these gigantic jellyfish?
Only in photos, and they are incredible. They really are that big, and they're toxic. They sting as well. But it's amazing because about a half a billion or 500 million of these things are drifting into the Sea of Japan fishing grounds every day. So, from China, where they're just breeding and breeding and breeding. So you can imagine the havoc that those sorts of numbers are causing in Japan.
I gather they're also getting caught up in these fishing nets. Bill Dennison, you said you had seen one catch. When? What happened?
Well, we had a trawl that we took through to catch fish, and unfortunately we encountered a big swarm of jellyfish, brought them up, and then as we lifted that net up with a hydraulic winch, it was out of the water. The whole stern of the boat went under, and we started getting water onto the deck. So we had to break had to put the net back in and go in and pull the cot in open and release the net because we literally couldn't bring it onto the boat.
Lisa, how long would a jellyfish, say in the Sea of Japan, live to reach this enormous size?
Yeah, that's a really good question. We don't know how long the Nomura's jellyfish live, but we think that they are born, grow, and die within a season. So these things are starting out as just tiny, tiny little things, about as wide as a dime is tall if it's laying flat on a desk. And tiny, tiny little things, the width of a dime. And they grow up into these enormous sizes, the size of refrigerators.
In one season?
Yeah, in a matter of months.
Wow.
And, because they're eating so much plankton that's in the water.
I see.
But that means that other things aren't able to eat that plankton.
Exactly.
So, that balance has been shifted so completely over to jellyfish.
Let's go to Westchester, New York. Good morning, Bob.
Hello.
Hi.
I love the show.
Thanks.
And, I was a bayman on Long Island for about 20 years, and I'm still representative of the Baymen's Association on Long Island. I had a question for the guest.
Go right ahead.
So this time of year, we see, I think we refer a common name as comb jellies, but I'm not positive of the genus and species. And they bloom, and their bloom seems to be coincide with the time when clams and oysters spawn. So the free-swimming larvae from the clams and oysters, which is part of the plankton, for a week or 2 weeks, is, I think, one of the primary foods of these jellies. And I wanted to know what the guests thought about the effect on shellfish larvae in the water column.
Ew.
Yeah, Bob, that's a good question. I actually was at Stony Brook for a few years, so I know the I know the waters around Long Island, and that comb jelly that you were seeing is most likely Mimeopsis leidii. It's a beautiful little thing, and they are voracious. They eat fish larvae and plankton. They in Chesapeake Bay we've got them down here too. And one of the things that we've learned is that the sea nettle, the big stinging nettle, actually the oyster larvae can pass through them intact. So they might ingest them, but the larvae escape, where they don't escape the comb jelly. The comb jelly, which is a tenophore, not a true jellyfish, but it does. They are voracious and they do eat fish larvae.
All right, Dan, Jack Covert, to what extent are you concerned, as Lisa is, that this may not be simply a 20-year cycle, but that, in fact, the jellyfish are proliferating and cleaning out the ocean for their own consumption, leaving waters affected rather substantially?
Well, some things we know for sure. We know that human activity, we are, number one, transporting jellyfish all over the world. For example, ships going from the Mediterranean over to this part of the world, when they take off all of their cargo, they oftentimes take on ballast water, which they dump. So the little Leidy's comb jelly that Bill was just talking about was transported to the Black Sea in the early 80s. It went into the Caspian Sea, went into all these different areas. So we definitely know that there's invasive species. We're seeing Australian jellies show up around the U.S.
Huh.
So we're definitely have an invasive species issue. I think that, it's an altered world. I think the things that humans are doing, unfortunately, are affecting the biodiversity. So I would agree that, as we do unnatural things, we catch large numbers of fish and we get more proficient at catching those fish. So what we really have to do is pay attention to what the scientists are seeing and react to it. But there's long-term studies, and like I say, I think the jury is still out, but I would say that definitely we are living in a different world, and the jellies have been around without a brain for over 500 million years. Humans haven't been around too long. We sort of came at 1 minute before midnight to the party, and we're sort of wrecking the house. So we really need to look at many of our activities and look at make sure that we're not knocking the ocean out of balance, acidifying it.
To Fredericksburg, Virginia. Hi, Bobby. Thanks for waiting.
I love your show like everybody else does.
Thank you.
I'm listening to this last part about how big they can grow struck terror in my heart, because my introduction to Boston as a little southern girl from Virginia moving up there, where my husband was from, we went into the waters, and I think it was Wollaston or else Nantasket Beach, and you don't have the ocean immediately next to Fredericksburg, to say the least. So I'm in the water, and the it was dusk time, and the light from the pier was shining through, and I saw these beautiful creatures, a whole bunch of them. They must have been only, thank God they weren't 500 pounds. They probably were about a foot and a half, maybe, in diameter. And I picked one up. I put my hand out, and I touched it at the part, not where the nettles were, and I didn't even know what they were hanging down, and it felt like a little spongy kind of a thing. And I thought they were absolutely beautiful. And when I went back to my family and told them what I had done, they said, "Are you crazy? You could have gotten stung." And now I wonder, I don't think I would have picked it up if it did any bigger than what it was, but
yeah,
they were absolutely beautiful.
Well, they are beautiful, aren't they, Jack?
They are, and the species you may have seen may have been a moon jelly in the genus Aurelia, which has some tentacles, but they really will not penetrate the callus part of your hands. If they were on a more tender part of your body, you might feel a slight sting. So not all jellyfish sting, and like I say, the comb jellies don't sting at all. However, if you were in Australia, that probably would not have been a good thing to do. Jellyfish there that basically are incredibly toxic. We don't quite understand why the box jelly, for example, is so toxic. It's like, since they're feeding mainly on plankton and small fishes, it's like going squirrel hunting with a nuclear cannon.
And Lisa is director of the Australian Marine Stinger Advisory Services. Talk about that in Australia and the number of people unknowing perhaps who are stung.
Yeah, well, it's a very serious issue. In Australia, we get about 100 hospitalizations a year from what are known as irukandjis, which are a very strange group of box jellyfish. There's about 14 different species that we know of so far. And, you know, they range in size from the size of your pinky fingernail to the size of a takeaway mocha. You know, so they can be quite large, but most are quite small, and they are highly toxic. They can be deadly, and you know, it's a very serious issue.
Even the very tiny ones?
Yeah, particularly the small ones. You know, you don't even feel the sting most of the time. They're so small and so minor and so insignificant in so many ways.
So who's going into the water in Australia if you can't even see these little suckers?
Well, luckily, they're only around under very specific conditions a couple of days a year. And the trick, of course, has been to work that out. I'm glad to announce that the CSIRO, which is the Commonwealth Scientific Organization in Australia, has actually worked out the model to predict these things. I should also say that they're not only in Australia. Irukandjis occur from as far north as North Wales in the United Kingdom to as far south as Cape Town. And we get stings every year in the Caribbean and Florida, Hawaii, Japan,
so
Thailand.
So they're clearly migrating.
I don't think they're migrating. I think they just haven't been recognized.
I see. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. To Cincinnati, Ohio. Austin, you're on the air. Austin, are you there?
Hello?
Hi there. Go right ahead, sir.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
I had a small comment and question. There seems to be a lot we could learn from the water life around us on Earth. And earlier, you were discussing some unique traits of certain jellyfish, and I was wondering if your panel could illuminate for your audience a certain jellyfish. It's called the immortal jellyfish. Its scientific name is Turritopis nutricola.
All right, Bill Dennison.
The bizarre life cycles of jellyfish that Lisa mentioned earlier are that they have this free-floating medusa stage, the one that you see in the water, and you have this little sedentary polyp phase, these tiny cryptic little polyps that are on the bottom. And one of the things that we are concerned about is this term called ocean sprawl. So we're building more structures into the ocean, more piers and more aquaculture pens and more coastal protection levees and such, which provide hard substrate, which are good places for these polyps to live and proliferate. So we can create opportunities for these in the coastal region for these jellies to live. And because they have this asexual reproduction where these polyps can split and divide, they can, quote, live forever. It's this immortality. It's the same genetic individual, but it's been
just going on
split
and on
and, split
and,
split.
And on. Yeah. Okay.
Turritopsis is different. Turritopsis is actually immortal in itself. So when the medusa dies, instead of just dying and disintegrating and turning to mush, the cells actually re-aggregate and form polyps all over again.
Wow.
So it's truly biologically immortal.
Yeah. And what is the best way to treat a sting? When I was a little girl, they used to take wet sand and put it right on that spot. Is that still the best way to go about it, Jack?
Well, I can tell you right now, a lot of the home remedies for jellyfish stings are more placebo, and
trying to make you feel better.
Yeah,
in
your head. I mean, you hear about and particularly here in Maryland, the use of meat tenderizer, even urine as a cure for jellyfish stings. And We, you know, have some research at the University of Maryland and a dermatologist there that basically found out a lot of these cures really aren't doing anything. When the tentacle comes and all these thousands of nematocysts fire that little harpoon in you, that venom is in your system.
That little stinker venom.
Yeah, and so what we really find the best thing to do is to get out of the water. And some jellyfish do have tentacles that are clinging to your leg that you may have nematocysts that aren't fired off. We don't usually find that with the Atlantic sea nettle. But basically, you just get out and take Benadryl or something like that.
But
there's sprays where you use have lidocaine and analgesic that will help get rid of the itch.
All right. Well, let's hope most of us stay out when the sea nettles are around. Jack Cover of the National Aquarium, Bill Dennison of the University of Maryland, and Lizanne Gershwin, author of Stung on Jellyfish Blooms and the Future of the Ocean. Thank you all for being with us.
Thank you, Diane.
Thank you.
Thank you, Diane.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Ring.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from